Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When investment performance matters, make sure your savings are with Zurich. Visit zurich.ie to find out more.
Now, India is to be added to the UK's COVID travel red list from Friday, forcing arrivals into hotel quarantine. This comes as over 100 cases of the double mutant Indian variant have been detected across Britain, with health officials investigating if it's more transmissible and if it evades vaccines. News of this strain will cause some concern on these shores too. As it stands, no cases have yet been identified here. Well, I'm joined now by Justice Minister Helen McEntee. And Minister, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Good evening, Sarah. Hi.
Are we looking at adding, first of all, India, but also the UK to the mandatory hotel quarantine list?
Well, firstly, in relation to India, if you look at the criteria that we have set for mandatory hotel quarantine, it is all about preventing new variants from coming into this country. We've set very clear criteria where you have a new or suspected type of variant, where one that is under investigation, but also you have quite specific criteria for the countries themselves, where we have high incidence rates, where it's 2.5 times our two-weekly rate, where it's, you know, set numbers 500 per 100,000. So they're very clearly set. So if there is a requirement for us based on this criteria to add more countries to the list, and we've seen in the last few weeks how we've added a significant number, then that's something that we will consider if it is presented from NPHET to the Minister for Health and then subsequently government. In relation to the UK, look, I think people will understand the significant challenges that there are to adding the UK on the quarantine list. Firstly, our common travel area, the huge flow of people and economic activity that happens between both, the fact that we have an open land border on this island, and obviously the consideration that we'd have to give to hotel quarantine, the capacity that would exist there as well. So that in itself, I think, is a challenge. But to your first question, if this is something that is proposed by NPHET, then obviously as a government, we will have to consider it in the same way that we have other countries that have been added only in the last week.
Mm. Okay, so India is clearly something that will be considered, but as you say, concerns or about the challenges around the UK, and I don't think anybody could dispute that. But are you saying it's not something that could be done?
Well, I think it's something that would be very difficult, in particular because of the open land border that we have on this island. How would that work? We've spent a huge amount of time, and I've spoken to you and many others over the last number of years throughout Brexit about the complexities and the challenges that exist, and the goal and objective for all of us to maintain that open border on this island. So I think what is more likely and what I see as being important is that we try and align in as much as possible with the UK. We both have hotel quarantine. We both have very similar countries that are currently on those lists. We both cooperate very well. So I was out in the airport and met with the border management team who are from the Department of Justice. They engage regularly with officials in airports in the UK and in Northern Ireland. So, you know, it's about maybe having as much close cooperation as possible while also looking beyond the UK to the other types of variants that you know, and unfortunately, we're seeing and hearing new variants emerging quite regularly, some of which are concerning, some of which don't seem to be having any kind of a different effect to, say, perhaps ones that we have at the moment.
If we take the Indian variant, it hasn't yet been classified as a variant of concern. At the moment, it's a variant under investigation, but we've heard from lots of experts in the UK in particular talking about how they think it's only a matter of time before it becomes classified as a variant of concern. They believe it could be more transmissible than the original virus, and also the really major concern around this particular variant is that it might be able to evade vaccines. Now, there are around 135 cases already found in the UK, some of which have not been linked to travel, which means that there is community transmission of this variant in the UK. It's only at around 135 cases at the moment, but there is community transmission of it in the UK. We know how fast that can transfer to here, because we've seen it already with the British variant before Christmas. So I'm wondering, is the government prepared to put in place a mandatory hotel quarantine system for travellers from the UK? We'll leave aside the land border for a second, but just in terms of people who are flying from Heathrow to Dublin, is this something that you will consider and put in place, or have discussions around at least, so that we will be prepared for that if that is something we have to do?
What I would say it is very difficult to differentiate. So it's fine to say, well, we'll leave Northern Ireland to the side and not include that as part of it. But this is all part of the one common travel area.
And I do understand that. And I'm not saying let's leave it and forget about it. I'm just asking about, there's a couple of different aspects to how people travel into Ireland, isn't there? And one of them is they fly from Heathrow to Dublin. And that's one that we have control over.
We do, but what I would stress since Christmas, and look, we've seen how quickly the B.1.1.7 variant has taken over. It's now the most dominant variant of those who have COVID-19 in Ireland. We've introduced quite a significant number of other measures since then. So anybody coming into this country, that includes people coming from the UK, they must have their PCR test. They must now have booked a second negative or second test 5 days later. They must mandatorily quarantine at home or in a residence. Giving those details, there are quite significant fines and measures in place. So we have moved. It's not as though we haven't done anything since Christmas, where obviously we saw the introduction of a new variant and the huge impact that it had on us here. But we do have significant challenges and there would be significant difficulties introducing this. As I said,
I think the
best objective
that
here.
I understand the cooperation. We'd love to have cooperation, but we haven't really yet seen the type of cooperation that we need, have we, on this particular island in terms of managing what comes on and off the island. We haven't seen that yet throughout the pandemic, so it's unlikely to happen the next couple of weeks while this Indian variant is increasing in transmissibility or in numbers over in the UK. I mean, I saw someone speaking to Sky News earlier today saying that she thought it could be the dominant variant in the UK by June. That was her prediction. So is the upshot here of what we're saying that because of the situation that we're dealing with politically with the border, that anything that comes into the UK is just going to have to come here? There's not a whole lot we can do about it.
No, that's absolutely not what I'm saying. And the very fact that people must have negative tests coming into this country, that they must legally quarantine at home, there were a huge amount of restrictions already in place. But the common travel area does exist. It is something that predates our membership of the European Union, and obviously a huge amount of work was done to ensure that could continue post Brexit. It allows people, for all of the reasons that it's there, to live, to work, to study, because of the interconnectedness of our two islands. So it does, and I know that's it's a very difficult thing to try and deal with, but I think we need to deal with it. And I would say there has been a huge amount of cooperation. We saw recently where we had numbers of people travelling through Ireland as a transit coming from other countries. There was a huge amount of cooperation between our border management teams, where information was passed on and where people were required to quarantine either in this country or in the UK, where they had been otherwise trying to essentially get around the structures that were there. So there is that level of cooperation and we really need that to continue.
I want to talk to you about the vaccine prioritisation list, because as I'm sure you're aware, prison officers are now planning to withdraw goodwill duties over what they say is a lack of clarity around when staff are going to be vaccinated against COVID-19. They say they're not asking for anything above the ordinary. They're simply seeking access to the state's vaccine reserve list. Is this something you've given any consideration to?
Well, look, government only a few weeks ago agreed a new process by which the vaccination was going to be rolled out. It is on an age basis. We know that because clinically the evidence shows that the older you are, the more likely you are to be impacted by this. So I do believe and I fully appreciate and the prison officers and our prison services have been absolutely outstanding throughout this pandemic. I do appreciate that there are cohorts of people that obviously would like to be vaccinated as quickly as possible, and we want to see them, and I want to see them vaccinated as quickly as possible.
But it's not going to happen for the prison officers.
I do support the clinically led evidence that has been presented to us. I do support the approach that we've taken at government. But I would say
there will be no vaccination change.
There won't be any change, but this new process will actually allow more people to be vaccinated much more quickly, and I think that's what each and every one of us want.
Today, if we could move on, the amendment to the Children's Act passed both houses. It's very welcome for a lot of people, I think. It means that a loophole in the law which prevented child victims of murder or manslaughter from being publicly identified, that loophole is going to be rectified, and those children can be publicly identified now. Can you tell us a little bit about that and when it's going to be introduced?
So today, the legislation that you've referred to has passed through all stages in the Dáil and the Seanad. Essentially, I gave a commitment and my colleagues gave a commitment before Christmas to families that we unfortunately saw, because of a ruling in the Court of Appeal, could not publicly talk about their deceased children. And these were children, unfortunately, who were murdered in very, very difficult circumstances. We have changed the law whereby if there is a deceased child, there will be no restrictions on identifying, talking about, speaking publicly, either by the family or by the media, that child. And you know, it's been a very difficult time for those families. So I'm really pleased that we've had the support of all members of the Houses to pass it. It will now go to the President for signing. He will hopefully sign it within the next 7 days, and I will then sign a commencement order. So at the very latest, this will come into law. Families will be able to speak publicly about their deceased children by the 3rd of May.
All right, Minister, I might ask you about stalking, because I don't know if you heard this morning two really horrifying, very difficult stories from women who had been stalked. They're now campaigning for a law which would define stalking as a standalone crime and for longer jail sentences. One of those women, Eve McDool, described why she believes stalking needs to be identified as a separate crime. Let's have a listen.
It needs to be recognised as a crime. You know, it's not... The word stalking isn't in the Non-Fatal Offences to the Person Act. It's just not there. It's not recognised. It is far more sinister than harassment. You know, it's a pattern of fixated, obsessive behaviour, and it's repeated, it's persistent, it's completely intrusive. You know, Scotland have done it, and the results there have really helped a lot of women and men as well. I think it's really important that the guards have the tools to intervene in the early stages so that it can be, you know, hopefully we can prevent anyone having to go through what me and Una went through.
Minister, what's your response to that clip?
Well, firstly, I just have to commend Eve and Una indeed for coming forward and telling their stories. It's really difficult to have gone through such a traumatic experience. But the only way that we improve our criminal justice system and the only way that we encourage other people to come forward is by hearing stories, as we've heard through Una and Eve. This is something that has been looked at, and I suppose in developing and working through COCO's law or the harassment and harmful communications, we asked a number of different stakeholders through consultation, so our law enforcement, so on Garda Síochána, the legal profession and others, to do an in-depth examination of the current offence of harassment, which is where this obviously comes under now. What they have, I suppose, very clearly outlined is that harassment is very broad. So it covers persistent behaviours such as following, you have watching, pestering someone, communicating with them, besetting them. And these are the behaviours that are exactly the same behaviours we associate with stalking, albeit in different terminology. So the advice that we were given and that I was given subsequently is that by introducing this, it doesn't actually change it. In effect, it might be more difficult to prosecute because you have two elements that would have behaviours that are identical. So I fully appreciate that maybe because the language is not there, that it's not referred to as stalking. I have tried to reflect in the Harassment and Harmful Communications Bill or COCO's law the seriousness of what we are talking about here. So anybody who is convicted of harassment, be it for any of the reasons that I've outlined, they could face an unlimited fine or 10 years in prison. And where we've referenced Scotland, where they have a specific offence, it is actually half the maximum penalty that we have here. And in some other jurisdictions, it's as low as 2 or 3 years.
Well, let's talk about those penalties then, because as you say, up to 10 years imprisonment is what's there at the moment. But one of the victims was speaking to Morning Ireland about all of this morning, Una Ring. Let's just have a listen to what she had to say about that.
I still don't think it's harassment is good enough. Like, the way I feel about even my case, like when he was messaging me, that's harassment. But when he came to my home on five different occasions, a 4-hour round trip, like that is stalking. And I think when somebody is continuously following somebody, that goes well beyond harassment. And like they're saying about the 10 years, like our guy's got the exact same sentence. But like the 5 years that James Steele got, he's going to be out in 2024. I already have his due release date, so he's going to serve three. So like 7 years reduced to five, he'll only serve three. So really, you can knock 50% off a sentence. So if they sentence somebody to 10 years, it's only really going to be five, and it's not enough.
So does a maximum sentence of 10 years mean anything when you have someone sentenced to seven and serving three?
Well, firstly, unfortunately, the court cases and the sentencing happened for both Una and Eve and their cases before Coco's Law was introduced. So I would hope that if you have such a serious scenario as both of those women have outlined, that this would be seen on the more extreme end of harassment. But, you know, again, the offence of harassment, it has been kept intentionally broad so that it can cover quite a variety of behaviour, but it does include following someone, watching them, pestering them. And this is not just online, which we have introduced as well, because we wanted to make sure that this is communications with people by any means, both online and offline. Now, I'm saying this and I, you know, we've just introduced and passed legislation on the Children's Act where we had to amend something that didn't work the way that we thought it would. Mm. So I am always very open where something is not working, where something needs to be amended. But Coco's Law was only signed into law in February of this year. We have a huge amount of work being done through Supporting a Victim's Journey, which is my plan to support and improve the criminal justice system for victims. And part of that is training Foreign Guard the Síochána Síochána for those who are working in the Divisional Service Protective Unit.
Okay.
But all Gardaí, so that they can, at a very early stage where something like this starts to happen, where it mightn't have gotten to the extreme end of it, what has happened to Una and Eve, but where they very early on can identify these types of behaviours and that they know that they can, under criminal law, that they can convict somebody of harassment and that there are very severe penalties that go with
it. I'm sure that is obviously a welcome development, but you were talking, and your department was also talking in a statement this morning, about consulting with various stakeholders in relation to the possibility of changing the law and introducing stalking as a separate offence. And I'm just wondering, did you speak to any victims as part of that consultation?
Absolutely. So everything that we have done and anything that I have done in the last few months around domestic and sexual violence has been through and with the engagement of, as I said, a lot of the state agencies, but also NGOs, individual groups and individuals.
And did they agree during that consultation that stalking was not necessary as a separate offence?
So the results of the consultation was that harassment covers already the behaviour that is encompassed in the current
offence.
Yeah,
but I'm wondering what
the
victims group said to you during the consultation.
So I suppose the response that I was given was the collective response. But again, I will always listen to victims. Everything that we are doing at the moment is victim centred, and the fact that this law has only been passed and enacted in the last 2 months, if it is not working, if we're not seeing people being sentenced, and you know the 10 years is to reflect how serious an offence harassment, but stalking is as well, and often you will see in judgments where harassment has been.
You will look at it
stalking
again if you feel it's not working sufficiently.
Absolutely. I think we need to continuously keep our legislation under review. Absolutely.
Can I ask you about Mass and the news that religious leaders are seeking legal advice on a new regulation which outlaws religious masses and services other than funerals and weddings and those conducted online? This has caused a lot of controversy and upset amongst religious communities over the last week or so. What's the point, firstly, in introducing this regulation this late, 1 year into a pandemic?
So really this was to rectify or to bring in line with other regulations that currently exist, in particular as we moved away from the 5 kilometre limit. So the 5 kilometre limit expressly states that you can only leave your home for exercise, but as we've opened up now to the county in the 20 kilometre boundary, that extends. However, what still is not allowed, and the regulations are clear, is that you can't gather in large groups, be it outside, you can't gather, be it in indoors in community settings, but also churches. And it was simply a matter of aligning the regulations so that would include churches. It's not to preclude or prevent people from being able to engage in prayer. There is still an option where churches are open that people can say prayer themselves, but large gatherings of Mass, as the restrictions currently apply to everybody else in these type of gatherings, are simply not permitted. Now, of course,
one of the concerns about the religious leaders is how this was introduced, as well as the fact that it was introduced. Many many of them met with the Taoiseach last Thursday about their concerns about religious gatherings not being allowed. They felt they had a very respectful meeting, but the Taoiseach didn't mention that this regulation had been brought in on Monday and no one had mentioned it to the religious leaders. I mean, is that disrespectful at the least?
I mean, again, what I would say is this was not to be disrespectful to anyone. This was to simply
But is that a disrespectful rectify. Way to treat people, to have a meeting with them and promise them that you understand their concerns and that you'll do everything you can to facilitate religious gatherings and not happen to mention that, by the way, we've just brought in and signed a new regulation that will ban them? Make it a criminal offence.
I think the Taoiseach is very genuine in his commentary that we are doing everything we can to make sure that religious ceremonies and masses can start to happen again. And obviously with the very positive numbers that we've seen in the last few weeks, where we as government will be meeting in the next week also to plan for the month of May, June and July, I would hope that we can very clearly set out when gatherings for mass will be able to resume. We know that funerals and larger numbers will resume next Monday, and we had set that out in our last announcement. This is not singling out any one group. This was simply really rectifying an element of the regulations that needed to be adjusted to bring it into line with everything else, whereby large gatherings are just not allowed at the moment. But of course we're hopefully moving into a space where we'll start to see them happening again and where people will be able to gather in their church in that way again.
All right, Minister, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thanks,
that's
Sarah.
Minister for Justice Helen McEntee. We'll take a break.